Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, show number 100 for Thursday, April 28th, 2011. A classy unichassis. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thanks, folks, for joining us again here for Auto Line After Hours. And with me, as always, my partner in crime, the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
John, congratulations. 100th show today.
Oh, that's right. Show number 100.
Show number 100. Roaster Jack sent us a note, says, to Auto Line After Hours, happy 100th. Don't ever stop. And Roaster Jack sent us his latest batch of coffee. Thanks, Roaster Jack. And a T-shirt. Birds, bees, and trees. I'm not sure.
Pollinator.
Yeah. So, thanks, Roaster Jack. 100 shows. It was just like yesterday, John. You're killing me.
It was just like yesterday. Yeah. Let's get on to today. And also joining us here is Chris Theodore. And I don't know how to... You're with Theodore Associates now.
Yeah.
Is that what you're calling it?
Yeah, it's our own little consulting company, and with some friends and experts in the industry.
But you've had an illustrious career in the business. Tell our viewers some of the stuff you've done.
Well, had the good fortune of being vice president of engineering at both Chrysler and Ford, and worked on second-generation minivan, PT Cruiser, Prowler. My favorite, of course, Ford GT at Ford Motor Company, the 2005 Mustang. Lots of Viper. Anything with
four wheels. You've done a lot of product there.
Probably about 10 million cars on the road that have been.
Wow.
You know, it's, yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And we want to talk about your new project now, too. But I want to talk to Peter especially. And you can jump in anytime you want here, Chris. A lot of news going on this week.
A lot of news. I mean, last week, of course, we forgot about the Beetle, but that's the...
Yeah, we're talking all about the New York Auto Show, and we talked all about the cars and didn't talk about the Beetle, and we were racking our brains. Is there anything else to talk about? Nah.
I did my column about it. I totally forgot.
That's hilarious. But, hey, how about Ford's profits? Pretty impressive.
How about Ford's profits as you compare it on Autoline Daily to Volkswagen?
Right.
Volkswagen, obviously... huge production numbers, huge sales numbers, but the profitability of Ford in comparison to Volkswagen, as you pointed out, was stunning.
That was stunning because Volkswagen did $55 billion in sales for the quarter. Ford did $33 billion. So $22 billion less money coming in, and it beat Volkswagen in bottom-line profitability. And that's pretty impressive. That just shows how efficient, I think, Ford is these days.
Well, it also shows that the Volkswagen Group philosophy, I mean, they spend a lot of money.
They do.
On their cars. And they waste a lot of money here and there. But, you know, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's not to knock VW at all. I mean, their performance was really impressive. Their balance sheet, their finances are awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, but... you know, when you take in $22 billion more than the next guy and he beats you in net profit, it just shows you how well Ford's really running these
days. Yeah, that's a tribute to Alan Mulally and his
But it also,
team.
And this goes back to our discussion here last week with Barb, and I'm going to butcher her name again. She said, no D, Samarzic, I think.
Smarjic.
Okay. Well, anyway, but... you know, as we were talking with her, Peter, they need Lincoln, and they need to build Lincoln up because, you know, okay, it's great to out earn Volkswagen for a quarter right now, but the writing's on the wall, you know. Yeah. One mass market brand is not going to put you at the top of the automotive heap. You got to have a luxury brand and to really make money.
Yeah, and it's got to be great, and that's their only opportunity, really, to get at the upper echelon in China.
If you think of VW, you just check where the profits come from, and you'll see that most of them are coming from the Audi group. So
yeah, you're right. Actually, Audi and Volkswagen brand had the same level of profits, even though Volkswagen, I don't know, probably outsells the Audi brand. I'm guessing, 3 to 1?
Probably more.
Maybe. You know, I got to say, that A7 looks unbelievable on the street. Now, I've never gotten used to this. All the times I've gone to an auto show, been in a design studio, you don't know what a vehicle really looks like till it gets out on the road. And you're driving, and it's coming at you or going away. But I'll tell you, that A7 is pretty spectacular
on the road.
I was kind of – I saw one turn. I had a good look. It was coming this way, and it turned in front of me and went the other way. And the way the thing sits, the view from the back – pretty cool.
But I agree with you totally. You know, you can go to an auto show and look at a car and think, meh, it's not very good. Or just the opposite. Wow, that's great. But until it's out on the street with other cars around it and buildings, so you see it
and
in total
lights.
Proportion and lighting, right, get a totally different impression.
Yeah.
Another thing that I thought was interesting, Hyundai surpassed Honda in sales and profits for the first quarter.
How about Honda as far down as they are?
Yeah. I mean,
stunning.
Stunning drop. And, you know, I don't think the earthquake explains all this stuff. The production disruption and all that.
Not
you know,
at
Hyundai
all.
Has been gaining on Honda all along. And I think the earthquake is an easy excuse that Honda could use. But, boy, that's a real shift.
Well, Hyundai's aggressive, and Honda's notoriously, it's not the original Honda. It's become a very conservative company that just evolutionary improvements step by step, and I'm not sure that's the right strategy right now.
And we've been talking on this show about this for 2 years now. You know, they're way behind in direct injection engines. They're way behind in anything over 5 speeds in a transmission, and so on and so on and so on. You know, in-car entertainment, you know, they don't have a sync thing yet. They're not at a My Ford Touch kind of a thing yet. And it's just shocking, I think, to be talking about how Honda is trailing technologically.
Well, in this business, if you have a lull for 6 months, that's you're in big trouble. They've had a lull for a couple of years now. Now that their leader announced in Shanghai, well, we're going to have an NSX, and we're going to fix this, we're going to do this. The lag, the time for them to get their mojo back, I don't know. They're in trouble.
And, you know, what's also interesting is Hyundai making more money than Honda is, okay, Hyundai sold a few more cars than Honda did. But remember, Honda makes millions of motorcycles and all kinds of power products, too, lawnmowers and wave runners and all this other kind of stuff. And so it's real shocking to see Hyundai out-earning Honda in that regard. And remember, that's Honda and Acura as well. So, again, it's got the luxury part of it.
Yeah, those guys, Hyundai, they are really aggressive. They're doing great products. They're getting better every day. I ran into a couple of the guys at the SAE show, introduced myself, and I hadn't been to Hyundai. I was on a study mission in 1989, and it was laughable, the state of the South Korean auto industry
in 1989. Oh, yeah, it was junk.
And to go from there to really being world-class in such a short period of time is just a stunning thing. And they had a plan. They said they were going to do it back in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, they have.
No, I remember when whoever the chairman was then, it was probably the guy who went to prison, came to the management briefing seminars and said, you know, we're going to be in the top 5. And I was like, what are you talking about? And, man, they pulled it off.
Well, he's back running the company. He was on the beach for like 10 months.
That's right.
The thing, you know, Hyundai was always missing two things, design and vehicle dynamics. Okay, well, they've hired some really hot designers now, and it's starting to pay off.
Dynamics, they're not quite there yet.
But given their pattern, they will probably figure that out.
Yeah, I was talking to John Krafcek, and so you got two things. I said it was the dynamics of steering's not quite there yet. The dynamics and road noise in some of their models.
Right.
If they take those on, and you know they will, they said, "I know, we know." So you know that's right. The next thing.
Well, my comment this week was about Lexus and how they've lost their way and they're in trouble. And you can't just blame the tsunami. And then they showed their new design direction in New York, which was an abomination. But Hyundai is going to, you watch, Hyundai will devour Lexus in a few years.
I really believe. I know, but, and as we've talked about, the Equus, which is Hyundai's luxury car, is just, it's a mishmash of different designs. They got to have the guts to just go, ta-da, you know, here's our design, and not this grafting of a Mercedes nose and a Lexus tail and a Buick side.
Well, actually, I think they're mad at me because I really trashed that car. I said it was reminded me of a Russian Zilwith. All the technological features, which are all there, but right. As a vehicle, it's not there.
I suspect the next generation one will not have those issues.
No, I totally agree.
The way they do that. But yeah, the Equus is a mishmash. But, you know, you're seeing some of their designs at Kia's. Some of the design work is really,
really good.
Really good.
Well, that's, again, Peter Schreyer, you know, the German that they hired away from Audi.
Yeah. So, you know, they will get hammered for the Equus, and you watch the next one will not be.
Will not have that problem.
Yeah.
Hey, is this the end of the road for Saab? They've been closed for 3 weeks, the production lines, and I think this is the end of the company. I hate saying it. I don't want to see it happen, but that's how I'm reading it.
It could be.
Well, yeah, I wish, and I know Victor Mueller, he's a car enthusiast, but they've got an awful tough business road to hoe. So if they get a little money, maybe they'll start it up again, but it's hard to imagine them getting the dynamics to, you know, to really get that thing going again.
People don't understand how much money a car company consumes.
No.
It just eats cash when you're in that.
Not only does it eat cash, you better be pouring buckets of it into your future product development at the same time.
Yeah.
As you all well know too well.
Lord knows I do. But the problem with Saab is that there's a terrible business equation. Truth be told, inefficient plants, inefficient structure, none of that got addressed. You start up again, okay. Now you got to sell some units to get some cash. And if you aren't selling units, the register's not ringing, you're not going to be able to pay your suppliers, and that's what's happened. You got great plans, but you got to get there, and that's looking pretty tough.
Yeah, I hope Victor can pull it off, but I think it's over. That's how I'm reading it. Another interesting development this week, Chrysler sold off GEM, which was this electric car, neighborhood electric car company that they bought back in the Daimler days, probably when you were there, Chris. You guys bought, or was that?
Yeah, actually, it was just in the last year, or maybe just, it was the last year that I was there, bought GEM as a good way to defend oneself against the California EV mandate at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they made money on it, you know. So over the last 10 years or so, they have made money on GEM. But, yep, it's a goner. Somebody cashed in.
Well, I put three things together. When Nardelli was there, he bragged about how he had teamed up with General Electric because they had a breakthrough battery. And they formed the NV team, which was, they had developed, what, an electric sports car, an electric Jeep, and something else. Was it a pickup? I can't even remember.
No, I think it was a big Chrysler concept car that they showed off.
Uh-huh. But anyway, NV got closed down. Nardelli's gone. The battery breakthrough with GE never went anywhere.
Well, NV got, I hope the guys don't get mad at me, but NV was a bit of a mirage to begin with.
Oh, it was smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. So
it's okay.
The guys will probably admit it. I'm worried about my friends back at Chrysler. They don't
yeah,
get
I,
mad at
I could say it. I said it on the website, so you can blame me.
Well, you say everything on the website.
But and now they've sold off GEM, and I'm saying Chrysler has gotten out of the EV business. Fiat Chrysler. Excuse me, Peter. Thank you. They're not going to do EVs.
No, apparently not. They're not in really good shape in the next 2 years in terms of mainstream car to run up against the Focus and the Cruze.
No, they're not. Well, they got nothing there.
Yeah.
Nothing there. It's, you know.
And everyone's looking at their watch, and they keep saying 2014. Boy, 2014 is going to be great. I don't know, $4 and $5 a gas, a gallon gasoline between now and then. It's going to be tough.
Well, I'm pretty proud of the guys. Honestly, they've come farther and faster. I ran into Marchione about 6 months ago, and I said, I call them my kids, you know, but the guys that used to be on my team at Chrysler, the hypos back then, are now running the company, and I said, you're working these guys to death. They've literally been working 24/7, and I says, you know, give them a break once in a while. He says, well, I'm working pretty hard, too. They've done a great job. The products they've got are good products.
Stuff on the road is great stuff.
But they've done a great stopgap job with what was really an abysmal lineup of small and medium-sized cars. They've shorted up as best they can. But you're right. Now we're waiting, and I think they'll be okay. But that's it. We got to see what happens with the C&D cars they come out with.
I think they've done a brilliant stopgap job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we'll have to see once they get the new platforms in how it all goes. But I totally agree with you, Chris. They're working like dogs, and it's a good thing they're all young.
Oh, I'm telling you. And they got more gray hair than me already. So it's you know, they are working
young for long.
Yeah.
But they may be handsomely rewarded in the end, too.
Well, they probably will be. But, you know, my fear is Sergio. Here's a guy running two companies. He's got a very flat organization. He's got something like 32 or 35 people reporting to him. As we've talked about on the show before, what if, God forbid, he steps off the curb and a bus hits him? Who's going to replace that guy? I don't see anybody at Chrysler that could do it right now, and I'm not sure that there's anybody at Fiat that could. And if I were the board at Fiat, I'd be deathly worried about what happens if something happens to Sergio.
Well, you got to say he's a pretty special guy. He's doing a marvelous job, and he cuts to the chase, and he's doing the things in Europe, which nobody else in Europe, by the way, is doing.
That's
so
right.
We say Volkswagen's wonderful, and they are, and they're conquering the world, and, you know, they're going to be number one, but Volkswagen hasn't restructured in Europe.
Right.
Nobody's restructured.
Nobody has. The closest is Ford, and they didn't really restructure, but I think they got things.
Ford's got their, and GM's starting to get their act together. But but you talk about the Volkswagens, the Mercedes, the BMWs, none of that's happened. Nobody's restructured.
Yeah, but look, and here's Sergio trying to do it in Italy, and he's got the communist union, you know, breathing down his neck now.
Right. He doesn't flinch.
No.
He does not flinch.
One more news thing, and then we'll get into talking about your stuff, Chris. But, you know, we had Barb, how do you say it, Samardzic? No, I said it with a D. I'm going to say it my way. But we're talking about how the Lincoln MKZ you can get as a hybrid or a regular internal combustion gasoline engine. But you can get the hybrid now at no cost. So I did some digging, and I did get the numbers. And what it turns out is that the hybrid version of the car is running at about 22% of the mix, which means 3 out of 4 drivers or buyers are saying, no, thank you, I don't want the hybrid, even though it's at no extra cost. And to me, this is a real eye-opener because J.D. Power came out this week and said, well, hybrids aren't selling well because you got to pay a premium to get them, and you know all people want to do these days is save money. But here's a great comparison of saying, no, there's zero premium to buying this hybrid version. And like I said, 3 out of 4 people are saying, no thanks, I don't want it.
Well, I think it was a good marketing move on their part. I think it was a very good marketing move. But, you know, you're still talking about Americans. It is an entry-level luxury product. And you can have a V6 or you can have a hybrid. Well, people still like V, you know. That'll change. Gas prices go up. But that'll change a little bit. But you're right. It's not. There hasn't been a mad rush to. Although in California, I guess the run rate's quite a bit higher.
The run rate is at 60% in Southern California.
I bet it starts going up.
I'm sure it will. I'm sure this month that the penetration will be higher. But I would have thought, based on what we're told, everybody wants a hybrid. So I'm not so sure that's really the case.
How about Hyundai guaranteeing resale?
Well, these guys know how to market. Man, do they
know
how to market.
Well, they take chances.
They do.
They take chances, and they know how to get noise. They generate noise. They generate attention. And
I think it's a great idea. I mean, how did Hyundai get on the map? Well, everybody said, you don't have quality. I'll give you a 100,000-mile warranty. Yeah. Okay? We go into a recession. Don't worry about your job. I'll take care of you. And now what are you going to do? Okay? I think it's a good plan. Because
yeah,
it says, look, we got residuals now.
Yeah, they address
we'll guarantee them.
They address the issue. The other knock on Hyundai was, the cars don't have any resale value.
Right. Interesting stuff. Hey, why don't we take our first commercial break here? Ben, why don't you play the ad there? Or no, it's up to me to do it. Ben, just sit tight.
How many shows have we done, Jack?
Yeah. Only 100?
It's 100. You got to do it yourself now.
So we got to do one for Bridgestone because it's featuring its third generation of run flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third generation Bridgestone run flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. So, Chris, we talked a little bit about your car career. Let's talk about this new thing that you've got going. You're calling it a new way of making automobiles, or more specifically, unichassis. I'm looking at a brochure right now that's got this really beautiful aluminum kind of torque tube chassis with a, looks like a Cobra body hovering.
Yeah, Carol sent me a nice body to get everybody's attention.
Carol Shelby did.
Yeah.
So tell us, what is this thing? What are you doing here?
Well, it started out, you know, after the Ford GT, I wanted to do the Cobra concept and the Shelby GR1. And the problem with low-volume specialty vehicles is the business case. High investment, you know, high variable costs. Oh, there you go. You got it on the screen.
On the screen, yeah.
That's great. You guys are good. And even after I retired, I said, there's got to be another way. And the funny thing is I was I hadn't watched the movie Grand Prix in like 40 years. And they zoomed in on a Lotus 33 Formula One car. And I'm looking at that car, and I said, that's the year that Colin Chapman attached the suspension to the powertrain. And, of course, he was the first with the monocoque tub. And as they zoomed in on the driver, I said, too bad they had to cut a hole in it for the driver's head to stick out of. They lost all the torsional stiffness. And that's when, you know, I just had one of those aha moments and said, you know, I bet you if we had a torque tube, maybe 6-8 inches in diameter, rigidly attached the suspension to rigid engine and transmission, we could have a really efficient chassis that'd be low investment, low cost, low weight. So I did some calculations and couldn't figure out why anybody hadn't done it. So I went out to see Carol Shelby. I said, Carol, have you seen this before? He says, no. He said, don't show it to anybody until you patent it. So, you know, checked it out with a few other people that I trust in the industry, and it looked like it worked. We did the patent search, and we decided to go ahead and do the analysis. We did the structural analysis. That chassis is stiffer than a Ford GT chassis in torsion and almost twice as strong in bending.
Now, describe it a little bit for anybody who's just listening and can't see it.
It's such a simple idea. It's basically, in this particular version, we've got the engine in the front, but it's stressed. So the engine is rigidly mounted. You got the transaxle in the back for good weight distribution.
Same thing. It's
that's stressed. So the suspension loads are actually taken in by the front and rear structures. And then normally, if you know, torque tubes are not new. They go back to an Austrian engineer by the name of Ledwinka from the 20s. But now that you make the engine and transaxle rigid, you upsize the torque tube to do all the other functions of the chassis.
And so the torque tube, instead of having like a ladder chassis, this is just a tube runs down the center of the chassis that attaches the front and rear ends to it.
So here's the great thing now. Yeah, I mean, the investment's low. The variable cost is low because they're extrusions.
Dirt cheap. The tooling you could do with my credit card, you could do the tooling.
We're flexible. You know, tell me what wheelbase you want, and I'll slice a different length of sausage for it. I mean, it's a really simple idea. And then, so that was for specialty cars, and clearly the aftermarket, all the hot rodders got all these garbage cars running around, you know. We can have a proper chassis. And then a lot of interest in plug-in hybrids and electrics, because if you think about it, with all the talk about them these days, whether you believe or not they're coming, you got 400 to 800 pounds of batteries that you're going to put in the car. Then you got to create a battery box to hold the 400 and 800 pounds of batteries, 2G loads, so double those loads. Then you have to reinforce the body to hold the battery box to hold the batteries. Take that tube, in essence, a slightly different tube, make a torsional battery box or structural battery box. You're getting the battery box for free, and the two enemies of batteries and plug-in hybrids are weight and cost. So I'm not saying that solves the problem, but I'm saying reduces the cost differential for battery electrics and hybrids. So
how did it go over at the SAE show? So what happened there?
I was really, really pleased with all the attention we've got. Got a lot of attention, obviously, from the press. More importantly, not to diss the press, but more importantly, the OEs came by. Most of the OEs are interested primarily for the plug-ins and battery electrics, but a couple showed interest in the specialty vehicles that are my love as well. I had two or three startups come by. Perhaps the other thing is, it was kind of a funny experience because you are exposing yourself to the world's engineers. And so they're there to take pot shots and critique it and whatever else. And we've got nothing but positive comments. I mean, there are some questions. People ask, what about side impact? And I said, well, think about a pickup truck body. It takes care of the side impact. This will take care of the front and rear impact. And so we got a great response from the engineers, which is kind of reassuring.
Cool.
As well. So we'll see how this thing moves.
So who designed all this stuff? Who did all this work on it?
Well, you know, I did the design work, and then I got my old friend Manfred Rumpel, who used to be my advanced chassis engineer at Ford. And when he retired, he formed a small design crew. His resume includes the Porsche 917 Can-Am car, so he's one of the chassis experts.
You got to know a few things, yeah.
So I said, Manfred, will this work? Yes, Chris, it'll work. And no, it's not been done. Okay, Manfred, let's go do it. So and then I went to probably the best fab shop is right here in Livonia, Technosports, and Carol supported me with the body, and my friends at Ford, Derek Kuzak, was interested enough to say, okay, we'll sell you a Ford GT. One of the prototypes was going to go to the crusher. They sold that to me to Field Strip. So this thing's got, which is cool too, it's got a 4 GT motor, 4 GT suspension. So if everything comes to naught, I'm still going to have the world's fastest, best handling Cobra in the universe. So it's okay. So I'm happy. That's just one of the ideas I'm working on. And you can't stop thinking when you retire, you know.
No.
And it was a way to sell the consulting business as well, to make people aware of what we're doing. So
cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
So you say this is just one of the things you're working on. What else are you working on?
Well, you know, you got to make some money out of these. This is an expensive hobby. this is all self-funded here. So you do your consulting so you can work on some other stuff. I have a dream. I can't tell you all the stuff, but probably a half dozen that are in various stages. But I have a dream of doing I want to put the third world on wheels. I have a dream of doing a $500 vehicle.
Wow.
So
blow Tata into the weed.
Well, Tata was brilliant exercise in and of itself.
Yeah.
And then you notice I called it a vehicle, not a car. But I think the third world needs, if you go back in history and, you know, when the automobile was in it, it was a luxury item. And Henry Ford really changed that by building a vehicle for the masses. You think about the third world. The Chinese are still, you know, that market's developing very fast, and you got the rich, and they talk about the new middle class. But there's still about $1.2 billion that, you know, their sole means of transportation are
bikes,
are either by foot or by bikes, and now they're the electric bike market. Yeah. It's interesting, the Chinese culture, though, with the organization, they may not accept it. Everybody wants to move to first tier. But perhaps India, perhaps Africa. Mm-hmm. We've had some discussions, so maybe that might be the next one. So we'll see what happens.
That's pretty cool. That I'd love to see how you do a $500 car. That'd be pretty amazing.
So, well, I told it to Tom Gale, and he says, "What are you doing, the Flintstone Mobile?" And he's, you know, so he's, you never know.
One of my favorite cars that I wish you could buy was the GR1.
Oh, it's a stunning car.
Stunning car.
What's the GR1?
Ben, can you do a search? It's a
It was a modern Daytona.
Yeah, it was a modern Daytona that
remember, it was all polished aluminum.
Ford did the Shelby GR1, and they showed it at Detroit.
Yes, I do remember that car now.
Oh, still stunning. Who designed that?
A great young designer. He's half Greek, half Scottish. I love the boy. His name's George Sadoulakis. He did the new Mustang, too. He's off in England now. Still works for Ford. Great kid.
Yes.
And Henrik Fisker helped a lot, too. You know, it was George's design. But Henrik taught me a thing or two about surfacing, too, to get the highlights just right. Did a beautiful job. Well, there it is.
There it is, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Oh, man, that was just stunning.
That's a sweet car. That's a one-sketch design. So I wanted a new Daytona. Talked to Jay about it. George came up with the sketch. I've got the sketch sitting at home. And we said, that's it. Let's go do it. And he just captured it instantly.
Oh, man, it was just gorgeous. In person, it was just gorgeous. And that body, that polished aluminum body.
Really pops.
Yeah, it does.
So, what was your favorite car that you've worked on? Do you have one or not?
Well, obviously I'm partial to the Ford GT. I mean, that's to get a team of 30 guys together and go from zero to world class. That's a car that could stand tall against Ferrari. It actually blew away the Mercedes at the time, which was not that hot a vehicle, and could almost stand up to a Porsche Carrera, which was like three times the price.
Yeah, the Carrera GT.
GT. Mm-hmm. So, pretty proud to have a team like that and do that. But, you know, the other significant one was the second generation minivan and the PT Cruiser. I'm pretty proud of both of those as well, because second generation minivan, you know, okay.
Made a lot of money off that.
You know, people talking about financial performance and everything else, but it was the second sliding door. It was the rollout seats. It was all that innovation that we introduced. But, you know, back in those days, our gross profits on the minivan alone were $7 billion a year. $7 billion.
Extraordinary.
You know? Yeah,
wow.
those were interesting times. So everybody's excited about the money, you know, that's being made now. And I am, too. Great for the big three. It's wonderful. But, man, $7 billion just on minivans. Now, that's gross, not net. But
Yeah, still. But I remember when you guys did the left-hand sliding door, and you guys figured out how to make it work, and you were able to charge a premium when it first came out. And Ford then, the old Ford, doing the same consumer research, figured out that there was no way in hell anybody wanted that door there.
You know what? The research said the same thing, because I got to see both sides. The funny thing is the research, it's just how you interpreted the research. The research said a third of the people loved the idea of, you know, the second sliding door. A third of the people hated the idea, and a third of the people didn't care. So now, do you place your bet or don't you? And, you know, what it got to us on the Chrysler side is when you talk to the people that didn't like the idea of the third door, it was the mothers that said, well, I don't want my kids getting out of the left side of the car. But, you know, you got a child lock there, and you know that they were going to learn. And, by the way, you knew they were going to learn to appreciate the fact that they could strap a child in the back seat without having to walk around the car and all of that stuff. And so it's just how you interpret the data. We had the same data, same market research results.
Well, I remember doing the math at the time, and I figured out that the sliding door brought in Chrysler the first year alone $250 million in revenue. For a door.
Oh, I know. And the funny thing is, I really wanted to go 100% with the fourth door. And of course, we got a little tepid. We got to have both because of that third there. And the take rate was like 99% right out of the box. And so ultimately, the third door disappeared. But the three-door model disappeared.
Go back to the PT Cruiser a minute, because I thought that, right out of the box, it was a smash hit. But then nobody did anything with it.
Well, there were only three people that liked it in management. And, it was Bob Lutz and Francois Castaing and myself and of course, Brian Nisbet, the designer, who came up with it. And so with the three of us gone, there's nobody to, my opinion, nobody to really. It was an unloved product. You got to understand, designers don't like to do a product like that. A designer's job, just like an engineer's job, they're always supposed to move the state of the art forward. But really, your job is to find an emotional connection, and with our customers. And the PT Cruiser, the market research was just fabulous, and it made a connection. And you know, I would have liked to see it continue on because I had all sorts of, and we all had ideas on how to continue to evolve it. And they only sold 1,000,002 of them. I mean, that's, you know, it's only 1,000,002. It's a big failure. So,
what did you think of the HHR?
Another Brian Nesbitt design.
Well, yeah, Brian went over, and clearly it showed some of Bob's ideas. They stiffened up the backlight. The sides were good. I don't think they got the interpretation of the grill in the front. You know, it was too literal to the old GMC look. But that car did, and there were a lot of people that were betting against that one as well.
It's still selling.
Yeah.
I don't think it
had quite the style at Nesbitt's first design. And we had got a, Brian and I used to trade sketches back and forth, and there's other PT Cruisers out there that I wish had been done that were really going to be slick. So we'll see.
Yeah, you know, to me, when you get a hit in this business, pour everything into it that you can.
Oh, we had
just
plans.
Just see how far it goes.
We had convertibles. We had two doors. We had
panel wagon.
One of the guys on his own, one of the guys came into my office with, you know, a little Burago box, 1/18 scale. He modified the CAD data, and he made a PT Cruiser pickup that was the coolest. I'm trying to think of what they call it, the Durango. I think, Chrysler doesn't make it. You know, a little. It was so cool, and it would have been a big hit, but that one didn't come to pass either. So
yeah,
it was unloved.
I remember the design sketches for the reimagined Thunderbird were all better than the production Thunderbird.
Hey, let's take another commercial break. We got another one after this to take, too, and then we'll get into rapid fire. But let's talk about the Hyundai Sonata, because with gas prices where they are these days, if you're after fuel efficiency, you need to check out the Hyundai Sonata. There's three different models to choose from. The 2.4-liter GDI, which delivers a segment-leading 35 miles per gallon. The 2-liter turbo, which offers 274 horsepower, yet delivers 33 miles per gallon. And then there's the brand-new hybrid that provides a combined 37 miles per gallon. And you can learn a lot more about each one of them at HyundaiSonata.com. So what else, Chris? What else you want to talk about here?
Oh, yeah, I'll let you guys go wherever you want to go. I got lots of, just like Peter, I'm full of opinions, not necessarily facts. But
well, I'll tell you, why don't we get into
rapid fire.
Ben, let's roll it. Okay, Chris, Dr. Botox wants to know, how do you update a retro design like the PT Cruiser?
Well, the idea was, you know what happens, and this is an old Bob Lutz story, too. He actually got the design. We were so frustrated because Bob and Francois and I could describe the car in our head to each other in two or three words. And finally, Brian got what we were talking about. But Bob was so frustrated, he went to the designers and said, look. And he took various examples throughout the world. You start with the fork, and then the designers evolve it. And then the fork loses from five prongs, it's down to three. And then they got the modern forks, too. And then finally somebody says, you know what, the first fork was pretty good. And the ties, well, you know, narrow, wider, and then somebody has to change the paradigm again. The idea of the PT Cruiser really was to get people to accept a different proportion. And you couldn't do a two-box mini-minivan. It all failed, and even after the PT Cruiser, they failed because they just didn't look right. People weren't used to the proportions. When we did the PT Cruiser, okay, we took a step back. But now that you've changed the proportions and people can accept that new proportion, you can start to move that look forward again and modernize it and make it sleeker and make it... there's a lot of neat stuff that you could do. Make it more modern, futuristic hot rod look. and take it forward. We had some really cool. I had some cool sketches that we could have taken along. So you have to reset. If you think about automotive design, about every 10 years there's a breakthrough. You know, we were all organic in the 60s, and then Jaguar came along and he came with a clear folded design, and that went for 10 years. Then Audi came with the Audi 880, and the aero design came in. You know, and so you have to change. And then somewhere along the line, we took a bangle left turn, but that's time for a different story. So, you
know. Okay, here's a question about the unit chassis. Could it be modified to swap out battery packs of EVs? This guy says, I still don't see why the EV has to be parked for 6 hours, meaning to recharge it, when big standardized battery packs could be swapped out in 10 minutes.
Well, that gets to... Who's the guy that's Better Place?
Better Place.
Better Place.
Shai Agassi.
And yes, the answer is yes. If you did it, you can swap out battery packs. Why isn't this going to happen? It's not going to happen because there's not going to be a universal size D battery that fits all cars. The neat thing about doing a unit chassis with an EV, by the way, is so you do a small car, you got a small battery pack. If you need a four-door car, wheelbase gets longer, guess what? The room for the battery pack goes up proportionally with the size of the car, and you're going to need more batteries. I think the dream of these interchangeable battery packs is going to be a limited, you know, it's a little enclosed, where they're being tested, like in Israel, where you have a fixed market with fixed vehicles that you can interchange. And I think perhaps in the very, very light end of the EV market. I don't think EVs, by the way, that's another place we could go.
Yeah.
Well, let's go there.
You know.
I don't, you know. EVs are going to be select usability in urban areas, period.
And it's I don't understand why. I've done some columns on why it's taken somebody to just tell the emperor he's wearing no clothes here. I mean, 50% of the market is gone instantly by an EV, because you have it's a city, you know, it's a low range vehicle, and people have to have something that they can travel, go cross country with. Then on top of that, like we talked about earlier, they become more and more inefficient and more expensive the bigger they get. So it's going to be a limited market, and then you've got these people, as Bob Lutz would say, these MBA types that say, oh, we're going to solve all these problems with economies of scale. Well, economies of scale only work when you get down to the raw material costs, and forget it. So I agree with you. I think it's much more limited market than people project. And somebody came out today and said, oh, we're going to have, in 2020, the manufacturers are going to build 1.2 million fuel cell vehicles.
Oh,
I want to find that guy because I want to place a bet. It's going to be a big bet. I'm betting the house. So, you know, if he's watching.
I mean, yeah, it's not going to happen.
When I came up with the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation, when we were getting GM involved and all this stuff, the reality was that old story about, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles in about 20 years. Of course, that's like free beer tomorrow in the local bar. It's always 20 years, and it's just, oh, well.
It's a tough case.
Well, the thing is, look, hybrids work wonderfully well. They're not nearly as expensive as electrics, pure electrics. You don't have to put $2,000 worth of charger in your garage. And hybrids are 2.5% of the market. Now, they might go up a little bit more. Maybe they'll get up to 2.8 or 2.9% this month because gas prices are real high. And remember, half that market is one car, the Toyota Prius. And so when you say, let's bring in much more expensive electrics, range anxiety, and, you know, a change in consumer behavior, you better plug it in every night. I'll give them 1% of the market.
You know, it all comes down to regulation. And here the government is forcing... rightly or wrongly, a redistribution of the market. What's going to happen, no matter what, how you try and bias it, the low-cost solution is going to win. And people keep forgetting, you know, so if the fuel economy standards go higher and higher, and some of them are unrealistic that are being talked about. I mean, guys are talking about fuel cells because some of these truck standards can't be met with any kind of electric vehicle.
Yeah.
Just can't be done. On the other hand, like I said, the low-cost solution wins, and people forget After 100 years or so of development, the gas engine's come a long way. It's still got a long way to go.
Long way to go.
And you can spend a lot more money and get incremental improvements in fuel efficiency there before you start paying for a ton of batteries.
As long as you have politicians in Washington and Northern California dictating standards, we're in deep trouble. And that's got to stop sometime soon. What do you think of the OPOC engine?
Oh, John's working on that one, and it's Coletti.
Yeah. And I think it's cool.
It's a neat little motor. And
I think I told Randy Bernard you should get that at Indy. Let it run.
Well, I'm a two-stroke fan. Nobody says it's a two-stroke. It's a very cleverly designed two-stroke engine. It can be gasoline. It can be diesel. I'm a fan of it.
There it is on the screen. Oh, it was on the screen a minute.
You know, the thing about engines, and I got my own engines that I want to do, it's got two horizontally opposed pistons that come against each other, developing engines, people don't understand. It just, there's a reason it took 100 years to get them to where they are. And even, it's clearly, there's no new invention there in their engine. It's got pistons, it's got rods, but all the little details take a lot of work, and their money sinks. So they're... But I have a lot of good faith in John and Don Runkle, and it's a neat little motor. It's a good package. You know, basically, when you could do a two-stroke engine in various configurations, and that's a very, very clever one, you get better power density, and that's good. Save weight, get the same amount of power, you're going to get better fuel efficiency.
Right. But I'd put my money on the OPOC engine catching on before I think the electric car is going to catch on.
Well, whether it's OPEC or any other, but let's use OPEC as an example. The consumer's not going to care. Here, if you end up getting better fuel economy, you tell them, I've got this new flat twin opposed cylinder piston engine. They'll say that's okay. They can understand it. That's the next big thing. Just like people think a V engine is more powerful than an inline engine, they'll accept that. And I think that it would be well accepted, and there wouldn't be any hesitation in the marketplace.
They got to race it.
Yeah, they do got to race it.
Get notoriety that way.
Okay. Well, they got some work to do yet, so they got some customers. The guy that's paying the bills is going to be where they're going to be spending their money and their time.
Back to the questions. Steve wants to know, how can a $500 car sell in the third world when they wouldn't even be able to afford to fill it up?
I didn't say they were going to fill it up. $500 is about as low as I can imagine going. And again, I started out thinking about China, but you think about the China market right now, 1.3 billion people. We say, it's going to be 50 million cars. There are going to be 20 million cars a year. Okay, what's the whole car park? 70 million cars. So there's still 1.2 billion there that are on foot. And then now most of them, they do... They sell about 70 million bicycles a year, and the bicycle park's got to be phenomenal in China. And a bicycle's $50 probably in China. And now they're going to electric bikes, $150. At least it's a rational stepping stone from electric bike at $150, $250 to $500. I'm not saying we're going to do this overnight, okay? But if you look at the history of America, we went from farmers in the industrial age, and we worked our way up to the $5 a day wage. Then people could afford to buy the cars. You've got to have a small incremental step. I mean, Tata was great, but Tata, the jump is you're going from $250 to $25, really $3,000 now for a Tata.
Right.
And, oh, by the way, people can't buy them because they can't get the financing. So now they've got to do the financing for them. So as small as you can make that increment, that's the best way. And the fuel is going to be cheap. In fact, that's one place where an electric makes sense to me. If you get really light, and I'm talking a very light vehicle, then batteries start to take on more sense because you're not carrying a ton of batteries around. And you can charge them inexpensively. And
sounds like you're talking about a 2020 gem.
Right. It'd be a lot lighter than a gem.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And the gem's probably about $8,000 too.
Yeah, they are.
They're expensive.
They are. And I think there's a market, a federalized version of the United States where you can go 35 miles an hour, just like a gem, a neighborhood electric vehicle. If you could offer one for $1,000 that you could put in your garage, I mean, people, golf carts, markets up, all of that's up. But I mean, you're talking $6,000 to $8,000. If you could offer the American consumer something, a vehicle just to go to the grocery store or something for $1,000, I think you get some.
Sell them all day long.
And think about Disney World and uh-huh. vacation places and all that. That's my next dream project. Yeah. Anyway, we got an off on an aside there.
Glenn E. says, is the MKZ hybrid at only 22% due to availability? Very good question. In fact, that's exactly what I asked Christian Bokich at Lincoln PR when I called. No, they got plenty of availability. People just aren't taking those things. JJ says, if Saab goes under, blame GM 100%. The inefficient plants are not the big problem. GM stole all the cash, and no one can survive without cash cushion in bad times. I don't think GM had any cash to steal from Saab.
No, I'm sorry.
GM didn't steal any cash.
They gave the company away. Come on.
Yeah.
That's unfair. It really is.
Yeah.
It was a sweetheart deal to pick up that company, but quite frankly, you know, I was with a group. We were looking at buying Volvo, and we just missed out on that one. But Saab, when we took a look at that, that was going to be a tough, tough case. And even though it was a free car company in essence,
right.
And still, that just shows you how hard the business is.
Sure.
It's a tough.
No, you get it for free, and then you got to turn around and start pouring $1 billion into new products.
Well, they sold what? They sold 264 cars in the United States last year, or something.
Right.
Since the
something
end,
like that. It was a horrific.
I mean, you can't right. survive with that.
Right. Hey Ben, I see we got some phone calls. Let's go to the first one.
My name is Troy Hauser from Jackson, Mississippi. I would just like to say that I would like to see the Focus wagon return to the United States market. I don't want an Escape or any crossover. I don't like the high center of gravity. Volkswagen has the Jetta wagon, which is a good seller. Please bring the Focus wagon back to the U.S. Thank you.
Well, there is going to be a Focus, whatever they call that, people mover at Ford. It's already,
yeah, and,
already
but
in the product line.
Yeah, in fact, they showed it at the auto show.
The Vertrek. Is that
No. That's the SUV, but I lose all the names.
Yeah.
But there will be a Focus-based mini minivan, but this
called the C-Max.
C-Max. But he's worried about high CG, which is, by the way, center of gravity does not move up a lot when you make the roof taller. So yeah. Don't worry about the high CG. Yes, I do agree that the Focus wagons were really neat vehicles. And
I think the C-Max is going to be...
Right. And I agree with the guy. I love wagons. But guess what? Nobody buys them. I mean, the reason that station wagons aren't available much in the American market now is they're sales duds.
Yeah, I don't understand it because they're really neat vehicles, but it's apparently... You know, what's happened is that everybody has to have a two-box vehicle. The sad thing, in my mind, is two-box vehicles have also been associated with the... We started it with the Jeep Cherokee, really, but with the imagery... you know, the SUVs, and people aren't willing to get more rational. They don't need what they're buying and what they're driving, and you know, we're moving towards CUVs and all of that stuff, but they still want this SUV imagery and capabilities that they don't need or use, but that's where we're at so far. So that because of that, the station wagon does not enamor them.
Yep. Hey, let's take another quick break here, and then we'll come back to more rapid-fire questions. But got to talk about the Chevrolet Cruze because it's the car that's taking the world by storm. And a key reason is all the equipment that it offers. A driver information center, USB port, ambient LED backlighting on the dashboard, remote start with a MyLink app, two accessory power outlets, one in front, one in back, OnStar turn-by-turn directions, free for the first 6 months, and there's just too much to list here. You can check it all out at Chevrolet Cruze. No, excuse me, Chevrolet.com/cruise. And Ben, I see we've got another caller. Let's bring in the next one.
Hi, guys. This is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. My question for the panel this week is, what do you think the chances are that Fiat will terminate the Chrysler brand sometime in the next 2 to 3 years? You know, right now, Chrysler really only has one really great vehicle, the 300, and they recently announced the cancellation of some other products, some smaller cars. So I was just kind of curious, you know, now that Fiat's going to have more than 51% of Chrysler soon, Chrysler the company, whether or not Sergio's grand plan may actually, he won't have to play nice anymore, and if he just plans to terminate the brand itself, he doesn't have to hide it anymore. Bye.
That's not going to happen.
I give it 0%.
Yeah, 0% chance.
Yeah, no, they're going to keep the Chrysler brand.
Have to have a Chrysler brand, even if it's called Fiat Chrysler or Fiat North America, whatever, they're going to have a Chrysler.
It's a good conspiracy theory, but it's not going to happen, guys.
No,
Chrysler's around, and they believe in Chrysler. Yes, they're marketing as Lancia, or, you know, in other markets where that Lancia name is known. But Chrysler's going to be around for a while, and I think you're going to see more good Chrysler. Wait for these new D car to come out.
That'll be the make or break for them, really. Mm-hmm.
Well, I still say, and I'll stick by what I said, that before it's all over, it's going to be Chrysler bailing out Fiat, because I think Chrysler has much higher profit potential than Fiat does, much higher.
Well, and indirectly, I mean, Lancia's, and Alfa, lost brands, wonderful brands. They just haven't gotten any.
They don't make any money.
Well, and they haven't had any, you know, they've died the death of not having an being invested to develop a product that can generate the money to. So the Chrysler product's now being badged as Lancia gives them life. Chrysler platform's being shared to hopefully develop some need. I got to tell you, I think they're taking the wrong tack on the Alfa with this mid-engine car. Did you see the car at the show?
Yeah, they're just flailing away with Alfa.
Alfa should be, you know, the affordable sport sedan. I mean, it should be the Scirocco Plus of the world. And they're kind of, the last Alfa supercar was over the top, and now they're going to do a $60,000, $70,000 Alfa. That's not going to save Alfa.
No. You know? Alfa needs to be the alternative entry-level BMW that fights it out with VW GTIs and the low end of the BMW market.
And looks better than both.
And looks better in both. Design, flair, you know, Italian-ness, but, you know, doing 70,000, you know.
I don't get it.
I mean, the 8C Competizione, a beautiful car.
Sure.
But, you know, they're not going to survive unless they have that $30,000 killer car.
I agree.
Salvador G. wants to know, do you guys know if VW is still paying for that Porsche? Yes, they are. I don't know. Boy, that is like a business deal that just seems to go on forever.
I don't think they've closed it.
But they haven't closed it yet.
But it's pretty much a done deal.
Uh-huh. Buzzard wants to know, Chris, why did Ford kill the GT so quickly? Seemed like a great halo car.
Ooh, there's a nasty story there. The thing was, when we came out with the car, the promise was that we're only going to build 4,200 cars. And quite frankly, we wanted to continue the vehicle. And there were those in the sales and marketing ranks that said, no, we promised these people there's going to be 4,200 cars, that's it, and we're done. And I think that was an unfortunate decision, because we had plans to evolve second Mark II, Mark IV, four GTs. I even made a run at buying the tools myself so that I could go do it, and almost got it. But it didn't happen. So it was because they made a promise. They wanted to keep the promise. So we can say that's honorable. But when you talk to the 4GT owners and said, hey, if we kept coming up with a better and better and faster and better-looking 4GT, would you be in? They said, hell yes. Now, on the other hand, they've held their values. The ones that are there, you're selling for sticker.
Wow.
I'm so surprised, because I thought by this point in time I'd pick up a 4GT for $100,000. Not happening.
No.
Not happening at all. The Gulf color ones are still over sticker.
165?
Yep.
Yeah.
And we did a show at Camillo Studio this year, and now he's doing special paint jobs and everything for owners on them.
Absolutely.
Do you think Ford should do, this is my question, not from the audience, should Ford do a car to compete against the Corvette?
Well, let's stop for a second with Corvette. General Motors has to figure out what to do with Corvette. Corvette is the greatest bang for the buck in the industry. Wonderful car. and its sales are
nothing.
It used to be a guaranteed 50,000 units a year. What did they hit last year? 20? 18?
Maybe 20.
Yeah, they've fluctuated. I mean, in the 70s, they jacked up the production, and they were shitty cars, admittedly. The C7 that's coming is a transitional car.
Clearly.
Yeah, Mark Royce has promised, though, that the C7 will have a short shelf life. They're not going to let it go 8 years. They can't, no. Not in this market. The C8 is the car that's going to be the really pivotal, okay, if this is the future, let's see it. But the question is the C7 going to be compelling enough to get that volume up? I don't know.
Well, and it was kind of a long way to get around to the answer, but if you talk to the Corvette guys, and they do, the youth market is not there. There has to be a new Corvette, and I think the new Corvette has to be a new, smaller, lighter, more efficient.
Yeah,
you say Corvette and you say V6, and people, you know, traditional Corvette buyers, you know, their hair curls if they have any left.
But they're going after new buyers, so it won't matter.
So they have to do it. And so the answer is yes. Should Ford do one? No, not
the Corvette
we know. Would it be interesting to have, you know, a high-performance, lightweight, smaller, sporty vehicle? Absolutely. And you could even do some green things because you see people now starting to, you know, you can...
I always keep going back to the original Mustang concept, which had nothing to do with the production.
Oh, my favorite car.
Well, absolutely sweet. If I was at Ford right now, I'd get all the designers together and I'd say, okay, you've got 72 hours to give me your modern interpretation of this
the
car.
The Mustang one. It's over at the Henry Ford. I saw it last time I was there.
Gorgeous car.
I had plans. We actually did a study because I was hoping to take, actually, the Escape hybrid powertrain, so pack it mid-engine, do exactly a modern interpretation of that. We could have been clean,
lightweight,
green, sporty,
two-seater,
lightweight.
Incredible mileage, that, fun to drive.
Oh, and the neat thing about it was going to be a turbo. I was going to turbocharge it, so you could have the super fuel economy numbers, but when you wanted to goose it, you'd have the performance, to go with it. That's the car that got away. We had some initial work done on that. That's probably 6 years.
You know, Ford has the Mustang. I mean, the Mustang is absolutely essential for Ford, but they could call it a Mustang something else, a Mustang S, or, you know. I fully expect GM, when the C8 comes, that there will be three C8s, that there'll be a less expensive entry-level Corvette. There will be a mainstream Corvette, and then there will be a Corvette supercar.
Now, if I go back to Ford, I think, honestly, though, they're so focused, they're going to stick to their knitting.
Yeah.
So I don't think you're going to see
we won't see that
Corvette. And right now they've made it very clear, and it's long, long, long overdue, is to fix Lincoln.
Yeah,
I mean, I took
right.
a run at it, and
got all the arrows to show for it, right?
Well, you know, I went to the board and I said, look, here's the plan. We're going to have a fully competitive product, but guess what? We're going to spend this money and our return's going to be, the first year is going to be 0.2%. And then we'll work our way to 1.5%. And, you know,
Seem to get it now. They seem to know.
Well, it's a different world now.
Yeah.
Mullally's done such a wonderful job, and he's got a team going together, and they're all pulling in the same direction.
Yeah.
And so I'm convinced now's the time to fix Lincoln, and they'll do it.
Right, right. Danny Boy from Cleveland, Ohio says, Captain Peter, your suggestions on what IndyCar should be ASAP is very practical and makes sense. How about including diesel and other alternate fuels? Is anyone at IndyCar listening, or is your suggestion just like a small child's Christmas wish list?
Randy Bernard's listening. I spent an hour with Randy in Long Beach on the Friday before the race weekend. This guy listens. He understands that technical diversity is absolutely needed back. He understands that the spec series is a turnoff. But like you said, you can't just flip the switch. There's going to be incremental steps to get there. And what I wrote in my motorsports column this week is kind of a idealistic view of 2014. But I really think that Randy Bernard is going to move the needle enough to, we'll be talking about IndyCar more than NASCAR.
There's another one that's dying. I did an article, I'll have to send it to you. I think racing needs to be deregulated.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, yeah. It's silly right now because it's what I call nuance racing. If you're in NASCAR, you know, you a tenth of a PSI here, a little widget there, and you might, besides the fake flags and all that stuff, and you end up with a win. And Indy's the same way with the spec racers. And they end up spending more money building identical cars with slight nuances difference than if you really encouraged innovation.
Yeah, well, what
Can-Am was the best race.
Yeah, what I suggested is forget the rule book. Have a dimensional envelope for an Indy car.
Yeah.
That's one rule. The second rule is you get 50 gallons to run the 500 or the equivalent energy in whatever powertrain you're running. Other than that and all the safety requirement, it's free. You figure it out. But we're going to run at 50 gallons for 3 years and then we're going to drop to 40 gallons.
I like that.
And then forget the rules. You have a dimensional envelope. You got that car's got to fit in there because we don't want any minivans running around getting, you know, loaded with fuel or whatever. But you have a dimensional envelope. You have a set, you know, amount of energy to use. And you have to have the safety stuff. Otherwise, it's free.
I'm with you. And oh, by the way, whoever called in, well, it was a Cummins diesel one year at Indy, so...
Did they win?
No, they didn't win.
No, they didn't win.
They were on the pole, and I think
on the pole,
they
right.
ran well, but they broke.
What happened is, because I had looked into it, they ran for 2 years in the 50s, as I remember, and the turbocharger sucked in rubber, and it just gummed up the turbo, and that ruined the thing.
Well, let's face it. The magic at Indy, the heyday, was in the 60s when they were trying to break the 200-mile-an-hour barrier. And, you know... Somewhere along in the late 70s, racing at Indy and around the world became a game of, let's just repackage the rules so the cars will only go this fast. The reality at Indy is they've decided that they will qualify around 225, 226. They'll run and practice, nudge around 230. But we really want them to be racing at about 220 because the track, physically... safety-wise, they have to. Well, my attitude on that is if you give them 40 gallons of gas to run or 50 gallons, all of a sudden they're not going to be going that fast. You know, it'll challenge how fast you want to go, how many times you want to stop. You know, so you need to press the reset button.
Yep, I agree.
And but we've been, racing has been in a game of restriction since the late 70s, and it's unfortunate. NASCAR needs a completely new idea.
Oh.
You know, that this year there's more empty seats. You know, they won't even consider shorten the damn races.
Yeah, that's
except for
one.
The premier events. You know, the Daytona 500 and the Charlotte Coca-Cola 600 and a few others. You know, they shouldn't be 5 hours window on television.
Well, right. They've shifted to, it's become a NASCAR besides it being a circus. I mean, the only thing you can root for is a driver. What are you going to root
for? Oh, it's a personality-driven series.
Yeah, that's all it is. There are no manufacturers. I mean, when I loved it, you know, when you saw Richard Petty, and hey, the cars, it was Petty Blue. The STP decal was that big on
you
the lower right.
You
knew what the
car was.
You knew the brand of the car. You knew it had a real Hemi in it. You know, and it was running when the tunnel port Fords came, you knew.
Yeah, the 429 tunnel port Fords and the Talladegas and the, you know, and it's just this, as soon as NASCAR went to the car tomorrow, they signed their death sentence. They have to change that and they can't keep screwing around or people will walk away. They're walking away.
They are walking away. Hey, Ben, I see we got another phone call. Let's bring that in.
Hey, guys, this is Youngblood in Cleveland, Ohio calling.
Youngblood.
I see Ike laying on the ground. Is he okay? You want to check him out? Is he just sleeping?
Yeah.
Check him out. Later. Bye.
Yeah.
What a good dog.
That's good. Ike, hey, who was talking about me? Where'd that guy go?
Hey, Ike.
That's pretty good.
Ike's fine.
Okay, some other quick ones here. Jim Campbell says, I'd like to know why GM doesn't bring in more vehicles from Australia. The Utes are very popular there as courier vehicles. Vauxhall has a vehicle that would compete fantastically against the Ford Transit. Well, I think he means Holden, not Vauxhall.
Yeah.
But Look, I'll tell you, one of the reasons is UAW. I mean, GM had a nasty fight with the union just to bring in the original, the revived Pontiac GTO from Australia, because the union didn't want to see that car being imported. They wanted it built here. And it, I'm not saying that's the only reason, but that's just one of the many issues that you face as an automaker.
Well, there were a lot of issues, and the Aussie and the dollar are always fluctuating back and forth, and the shipping costs are high, and so on. The Utes are really cool. Ford builds a great Ute. I wanted to bring it over. Never could quite get the business equation right again, because most of them, now GM got the closest, because obviously they're right-hand drive, and GM at least had the Holden's designed for right-hand, left-hand drive. Why they were going to brand that thing a Pontiac never made any sense to me. But when they were going to bring with the Ranchero, which is...
I remember standing next to John Lochner at the New York show, and they showed that Pontiac version of the Ute. Yeah. He was all jacked up. I said, it'll never see the light of day in this country. I don't really think that here. I said, it will never see the light of day in this country.
And it's too bad. It's too bad.
But I would do in smaller, you know.
Yeah.
Like the concept for the PT Cruiser with the...
Yeah. That would have been sweet. They'll come. The world's got to globalize a little bit more. Australia's going through some interesting times now, too, because they have to restructure. They had... The market was big cars. You either bought a big Holden or a big Ford, or you'd buy the junk little imports, which is what they considered them at the time. And that market is shifting now. And so I'm not privy to what Ford and GM are doing in Australia, but you know both of them are going to be restructuring around smaller, lighter platforms.
Right. Jeremy Jones from Dallas says, "Happy 100." Thank you.
Thanks.
Why has Ford, and he goes on to ask, why has Ford and most other manufacturers delayed rating their trucks with the SAE J2807 tow rating standard? Is it because the ratings are likely to go down? And he's way over my head. I have no idea what that towing standard is.
You know, GM Ford and Chrysler boys got together to come up with a towing standard because it was a game. You know, everybody, I got 10 more, I'll haul 10 more pounds than yours. I know they've come up with a standard. I do not know why it's not been implemented yet. And I think it's probably a timing issue. Hmm. Or maybe they're still putting some...
Or maybe he's right. Maybe the ratings will go down.
They probably will, you know. And there was a lot of pride of authorship. I mean, when you get the Ford truckers and the GM truckers and the Dodge truckers together, the engineers, I mean...
It's war, right?
They're bringing their six gun to the fight. You know, it's they all have their own opinions on the matter, so we'll see.
Wow, we're getting to the end of this.
Yeah, we are, but we got a few more questions here. Ray Schaefer says, Chris, if you were to buy the first generation Viper, would you go for an early RT10 or a 96 GTS coupe with the iconic blue-white paint stripes? And why?
Well, I own an RT10, and I love it. It's my second favorite car next to the Ford GT. And I didn't buy a GTS coupe, the first generation. And I would really like to have one of those, too. The GTS Coupe's a more refined car, nicer car. Funny thing is, though, when you're collecting cars like I do, other than my Ford GT, I like the top to drop because you don't drive them every day. You only drive them on a nice sunny day, and that's when I want to have a breeze. So the GTS is the better car. Buy one of each. What can I say? But I love driving my Viper. It's so raw and crude and rude. What can I say? It's a fun car.
So Ray also wants to know, Peter or John, do you have an advanced copy of Bob Lutz's new book? If so, what do you think?
It's on the table this week. I read it over the weekend, and that was favorable. It was very interesting to how screwed up GM really was when he got there. That's the most fascinating part of the book.
Well, I'm not surprised.
No, I'm not surprised. I mean, I telegraphed it. I wrote about it. But he just, you know, validated it after the fact, how screwed up it was.
Jay Cujo says, can you tell me why GM is not promoting the heck out of the fact that real customers are getting over 1,000 miles on a tank in the Chevy Volt, and in some cases going months without needing a fill-up? I think GM is making that known. They're not doing it on television or in advertising. But, you know, word of mouth,
also
they are
not making very many of them.
No, yet. It's
so
just a few hundred.
They don't need any more.
It is a great car, though. And yeah, they
look great on the road. Ed Welburn's guys, they did a great job on it. It's got a real presence on the road.
They tweaked it. I talked to, can't think of the designer's name right now, and they fought for every inch to get the wheel set right.
Yeah.
It's a technical tour de force. And, yeah, you can get phenomenal mileage. And I told you, I tried to break one. I mean, I really tried to break it. It is, you know, it is really a well engineered vehicle. They should be very, very proud.
They should. And what they accomplished in the time frame they did it was unbelievable.
Especially with the company collapsing around them.
Yeah. Yep. They should all take a bow. And I said that on the site repeatedly.
We've got a bunch more here, but I got to get to this one from Indie Flick. He says, in celebrating your 100th episode, I thought it'd be fun to do a top 10 best guests on Autoline After Hours. So here he goes. Number 10, Robert Farago. He says, like him or not, he did help put the show on the map. Number 9, David Parachek, who is chief engineer on Mustang. Number 8, Tim Lulliet. That was a good show. Number 7, Mark Royce. Number 6, Scott Burgess. Number 5, Nina Beckhart. Number 4, Jason Vines, original co-host.
Oh, Jason says hello, by the way.
Oh, cool. That's great. Number 3, Jim Hall. Number 2, Sandy Monroe. And number 1, Bob Lutz. And that's a pretty good list. I'd add a few more. I really loved having Hal Spurlick here. That was a terrific show. I thought Nancy Gioia, from Ford when she was here, I thought that was a terrific show. And just 2 weeks ago, we had Bob Casey, the transportation curator from Henry Ford Museum.
Yeah,
that was a riot. I like that guy, too. So, and it's almost unfair to cite any of them because I almost need a whole list here to make sure that I get through all my favorites. But thanks for the suggestion. I like that top 10 list. And so
have them vote. Get them to vote online.
Maybe that's not a half bad idea there, Chris. But we should wrap up this show, and it's been great having you here.
It's good to be here. Good to see you guys.
Stuff. Yeah, that's and this Unichassis, good luck with that.
That's cool.
Well, yeah, I've got to fund my other projects, so but getting a lot of interest. We'll have it running this fall, by the way, so we'll take
you
it
a ride. You know, it's funny you mentioned about design and pushing PT Cruiser. You know, I'm pushing design. You go to the Pitchfork with 5 tons, and then 3. It reminds me of that Jerry Seinfeld routine, which is my all-time favorite he ever did, was he's just said, you know what? Tell me something. Why do the Chinese use chopsticks? And he said, you mean to tell me 1,000 years of working in the fields with pitchforks, no farmer looked at his pitchfork and said, why not use this to eat with instead of the sticks? I'll never forget Seinfeld.
That's great.
Okay, we got to run the billboard, right?
Well, we do, but Peter, thanks for being here.
Thanks, John.
Thanks all you folks, too. It's been great for show number 100.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.